Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of a possible strategic shift in the Middle East away from Saudi Arabia as the prospects of normalizing relations with Iran improve. Andrew Scott Cooper, the author of Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East, joins us to discuss the unusual alliance of Saudi Arabia and Israel, both expressing alarm at America's role in the recent P5+1 deal with Iran. Then we'll get an assessment of how the new agreement is being received in Iran and speak with Mehdi Simati, who is a professor in the Department of Communication at Northern Illinois University and the author of Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. We will discuss how the hardliners are dealing with the rapprochement and how the younger generation, who do not remember the Shah or the hostage crisis, see their country's role in the world. Then finally, we'll look into a new vision for the Catholic Church offered by Pope Francis in a just-released document that criticizes unbridled global capitalism, which he calls the globalization of indifference. Internationally acclaimed author and theologian Matthew Fox, who was expelled from the Church by the previous Pope Benedict, joins us to discuss the Pope's call for reforms in the Church to make it more compassionate towards the poor as he castigates the new idolatry of money. Joining us now is Andrew Scott Cooper, who is the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. He has been a contributing columnist to PBS Frontline's Tehran Bureau and a lecturer in the history of U.S.-Iranian relations. He previously worked at the United Nations and for Human Rights Watch and spent the summer in Qom, the Iranian city, the religious capital, if you will, of Iran, where he's writing a book on the Iranian Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Scott Cooper.
Thank you very much.
So let's begin with the broader questions about whether or not there's a possible strategic realignment underway here. You would certainly see from the panicked remarks from both the Saudi foreign ministry and from Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, who says this agreement's an historic mistake, that both the Saudis and the Israelis are worried. So I guess a lot of people in the Middle East see this as a zero-sum game, right?
I think in the Middle East now there is a perception that the old U.S.-Saudi alliance is changing, or it hasn't run its course. I mean, the two countries have very close relations in a different range of areas, but the alliance is not really working practically for either side right now. And I think you see that with the not only the dispute over the nuclear accord with Iran, but you see it very much in Syria, and the civil war in Syria has brought all of this to the surface.
That's quite understandable, because it is a bit difficult to understand why the Saudis would want Syria to end up as a Somalia on the Mediterranean. And one always wonders about what the real motives of the Saudi regime is, because there's been such a history of duplicity. And it seems like they export jihadis perhaps just to preserve the royal family. But after all, you know, the Saudis helped create the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, destabilize Pakistan, and they're active around the world, spreading the Wahhabi version of Islam, which is extremely xenophobic and in many ways quite hostile. So, you know, perhaps it's about time we started to ask ourselves about whose side they're really on.
I don't think this is a sudden break. I think there has been probably a long-term trend since at least 9/11. The hijackers were Saudi nationals, of course, but I think probably since the sort of late 1990s, with the bombing of the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia, the Saudis were not cooperative with the FBI when the Clinton administration sent investigators over, and there have been these tensions. But because of Saudi Arabia's enormous influence in the oil markets, the United States has had to really accommodate Saudi concerns in a range of areas. But the energy markets are changing, and the United States now, because of fracking and other new technological processes, is weaning itself off Saudi oil. And I think that's really what is alarming the Saudi regime right now. They do not have that ability to influence U.S. foreign policy. But I think there's a big picture, another way of looking at the big picture here, and that is that in the Middle East right now and throughout the Muslim world, you have a very, very dangerous split, a schism between Shia and Sunni Muslims. And this is something that is extremely dangerous and volatile, and you see it. You see these fault lines throughout the Middle East and Lebanon and Syria, but you also see it emerging in Central Asia. Both countries are vying for influence and leadership in the Muslim world, and this is a dispute that really I think the Western world needs to step back from, because and I think in that sense the Obama administration is probably making some strategic calculations here that it may not be in the interest of the U.S. to take a stand with either side. There is, of course, precedent here. If you go back to the Cold War, Richard Nixon and triangulation between the Soviet Union and Communist China, the parallel is not exactly, direct, but there are other ways of pursuing diplomacy in the Middle East. And I kind of have to give credit for the Obama administration here for at least thinking outside the box.
Again, I'm speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, who's the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. He's been a contributing columnist to PBS Frontline's Tehran Bureau and spent the summer in Qom, the holy city in Iran, writing a new book on the Iranian Revolution, and he's also been a lecturer in history of U.S.-Iranian relations and previously worked at the United Nations and for Human Rights Watch. But going back to the question, though, Andrew, of what is the Saudi motives? I mean, this is a society that has a very tight religious police. Obviously, they're ubiquitous. They also have a very tight secret police. The royal family run that place. They have a lid on it. At the same time, they're saying that, oh, we can't stop all this flow of money coming out. It's just private money, charitable money going to fund these jihadis in Syria. That's a bit hard to swallow. So what is, do you think, their motive in basically having the Syrian revolution? Effectively, what the Saudis are doing, or the jihadis that they're funding are doing, is they're playing right into Assad's hands, and they've discredited the Syrian revolution.
Yes. I mean, their motive is to land a blow to the Iranian regime. Look, Syria is just a pawn in a much bigger power struggle that is going on in the Middle East. And then Turkey is also involved, though. Turkey, of course, is a major Sunni power, and the Iranians are actually as concerned about Turkey as they are with the Saudis. Last year, I had a very interesting conversation with an Israeli professor who said that the Israeli perception is that you have these two former empires, the Ottoman Empire and Turkey, the Persian Empire with the Iranians, starting to reassert themselves in the Middle East. So you have Sunni versus Shia in that area, but then when you bring the Saudis into it with all the oil money, you have this extremely dangerous mix, and I think that any step that can be taken now to ease tensions and bring stability to the Middle East is a good thing. And it's really a concern, I think, that the Israelis and the Saudis are reacting in this way to a deal that, on the face of it, to many of us, many people who look at the Middle East, think that at least there's time now to work towards a more comprehensive agreement.
But what about the role, though, of the Wahhabi sect, who have, through petrodollars, have had a profound effect on the nature of Islam throughout the world, and they have exported this very austere and xenophobic version of Islam that, is inextricably bound with the ideology of the jihadis and of the al-Qaeda people. And without blaming Saudi Arabia for you know, Boko Haram in Nigeria, and even what's happening now in the Central African Republic, there is, I think, has been a very, very toxic, if you will, influence throughout the Islamic world. And isn't that what's driving the schism between Sunni and Shia as much as anything?
Oh, sure. And when I was in Qom, I was talking to an Islamic scholar, a Shia Islamic scholar, who talked about a friend of his who had who was teaching in a madras in Latin America, in South America. And by the way, the Iranian government also exports Shia teachings in mosques, and they also build mosques. But of course, they don't have as much money, and many, you know, fewer Muslims are Shia than they are Sunni. The Sunni are the majority. And he told me that his friend had been assassinated by a Wahhabi extremist while he was in country. So actually the struggle between Sunni and Shia is getting down to that level of the individual. It's not just the two the states that are warring with each other or using proxies to war against each other. This is a struggle that is starting to break now in different continents, and it's extremely dangerous because, as you can see what is happening in Syria, you know, these groups are, they are merciless. They are killing children. They are laying waste the countryside, and Syria, tragically, is being destroyed by, really by, I guess, national pride and a determination on the part of the Saudis to really block Iran from penetrating any further into the Middle East. So I should add, though, that when the Shah of Iran was in power, Iran played a role in Lebanese politics because Lebanon has a large Shia community in the south. It's just that at that time, the Saudis were not politically active in international affairs to the extent that they are now. They didn't have the confidence. So this schism, of course, is very old, but we have vast amounts of oil money now because oil prices have been so high. And I think that those oil revenues are very much a part of it. Some people are now saying, well, now that the Iranians will be able to start putting oil on the market in 6 months, they will be able to generate oil revenues. And I think that, more than anything else, is really alarming the Israelis and the Saudis. What they're worried about is the Iranians are now going to start pumping oil money into extremist groups around the Middle East, as President Ahmadinejad did when he was in power and oil prices were high. I'm not so sure that's going to happen, though.
Well, also, Iran, thanks to George Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, and Donald Rumsfeld, they ended up essentially handing over Iraq to Iran. That it would seem to be the case. And my understanding is that one of the ways that Iran's been breaking the embargo on its oil is through Iraq. So when you consider that Iraq is the world's second, has the world's second biggest deposits, I understand, after Saudi Arabia, and it's vastly untapped and underinvested. The combination of Iran and Iraq with a Shia-controlled government, that's pretty formidable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You're absolutely right. And the Bush people were warned in advance, if you go into Iraq and you knock out Saddam Hussein, you will end up strengthening Iran, and it will be very interesting to know what documentation they were reading, the calculations they were making at that time. But of course, we have to live with what we have to live with. But when I was in Iran over the summer, I was really struck by the level of concern about events in Syria, about the fact that Iran is isolated, that there is this potentially catastrophic confrontation coming with Sunni. I was in the room when clergymen were talking about the end of days, because if you understand the Quran and you have sort of a feel for the scripture. They talk about the end of days, and it is linked to events in Syria, and it is linked to a great battle in Damascus, and there are other signs for the end of days. But when you understand that that is the level of concern that is going on in Iran, they need this deal because they realize they are too isolated, and they have to start making friends outside the region. This is, by the way, is not something new in Iranian foreign policy. This is something that the Shah was very much involved in, forging ties with countries outside the Muslim world in the Middle East, because Iran is the only Shia majority country. But my concern is that Western policymakers who are not really looking at the sort of deeper issues here, which is really this Shia-Sunni schism, which goes right to the heart of what it means to be a Muslim.
So when you talk about being with these Iranian clerics in the holy city of Qum, what was the sense? First of all, you were just talking about the end of days. That's the so-called Twelfthers, right? And wasn't Ahmadinejad a Twelfther in the sense that he had that messianic belief? And by the way, here in the United States, amongst fundamentalist Christians, one of the best-selling books in America is the End of Times series. I think they've sold 70 million copies. Yeah. So we are not without sin in that regard of having those strange kind of pornographic theology of the end of the earth. In other words, our world has to end in burning flesh in order for their world to begin.
Yes, I found no sympathy, at least on the part of the clergyman that I spoke to with Ahmadinejad. One of the misperceptions, I think, in the West, in the United States, is that Ahmadinejad enjoyed the total support of the clerical hierarchy. In fact, he did not. He was detested by many of the clergy, and many of the ulama, the clergy, were very dismayed in 2009 when the Supreme Leader Khamenei intervened to throw the election to Mr. Ahmadinejad. They feel that that was a terrible mistake, and that it actually brought the entire theocratic system in Iran to crisis point and discredited in the eyes of the population, because it was very obvious as to what was going on. So Ahmadinejad played up to the ulama, but he was not regarded as one of their friends. And I think that Mr. Khamenei now is an older man. I think he is possibly looking to the future, and I really think that they know that if they don't take steps to address the economic concerns in Iran, they could have a popular uprising in Iran. There is real, I think, unhappiness in that country with the system. And throughout the Middle East now, you're seeing shockwaves reverberating from the Arab Spring. It is possible to overthrow entrenched regimes. And that lesson has been learned by people as far afield as Turkey, Egypt, all through the region, and the Iranians are watching too. So, we don't know where this is going, but the deal, I think, at least offers a little bit of hope, but I think that this dove of peace is going to have to fly very high and very fast to dodge the bullets, because there are some real enemies out there who will, I think, in the months to come, will be doing everything they can to scuttle this accord.
Well, just in closing, Andrew Scott Cooper, it does seem that, given what you just said, the election of Rouhani is probably going to save the theocratic regime.
They are hoping that it will, and there was great excitement in Qom with Mr. Rouhani. They are really relieved to have, at least I was, the people I was with were very relieved to have someone in there who was, they regard as a moderate. Now, in our terms, maybe he's not moderate, but in their terms, in their system, he's a pragmatist. He's someone who has had dealings with the West before. He was educated in Scotland, and the young people in particular are desperate for change, and they are desperate to start living in a country where they can have careers and they can start traveling to the West. And again, what you hear over there is, we wish we could come to the United States. And this sounds, you know, it sounds, I know it's ironic for Americans to hear that, but you hear this from the young people. They want to come to the United States. They want to study. They want to travel. They are ready to come out of 34 years of isolation. And I think they view the Ahmadinejad years as eight lost years. But with Mr. Rouhani, they have hope. And I have to wonder whether the Western governments, part of their motive in going along with this agreement, reaching accord, is to give Mr. Rouhani breathing space at home, because he really needs it. He himself has very dangerous enemies on the far right in Iran, and those people now are going to start mobilizing against this accord, and they are watching him very closely, because the slightest slip-up from him could lead the Supreme Leader to distance himself from him and remove the protection that he currently enjoys.
Well, Andrew Scott Cooper, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Andrew Scott Cooper, who's the author of The Oil Kings, How the U.S., Iran, and Saudi Arabia Changed the Balance of Power in the Middle East. He's a contributing columnist to PBS's Frontline Tehran Bureau. He spent the summer in Qom, the religious capital of Iran, where he's writing a book on the Iranian Revolution. He has also previously worked at the United Nations and for Human Rights Watch. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back getting an assessment of how the new agreement is being received inside Iran. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mehdi Simati, who is a professor in the Department of Communication at Northern Illinois University and the author of many books, including Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. His research interests include international and global communication, cultural politics of globalization, race and media cultures, and Iranian media and culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mehdi Simati.
Thank you very much for having me.
And I'm interested in getting a sense from Iran of how the agreement is being received, both in terms of the hardliners and, I believe, the young in Iran, most of whom don't remember the Shah or even the hostage crisis. So let's start with the hardline reaction. What have you noticed?
Well, the reception has generally been positive, notwithstanding a few disgruntled hardliners on the right. For example, Kayhan, one of the most right-wing publications in Iran, and websites such as Rajah News, they published commentaries that are critical. But these outbursts, compared to the positive press coverage the agreement in Geneva received, were minuscule. The conservatives, or I should say ultra-conservatives, have had no choice really but to accept this as a fait accompli, if for no other reason than the fact that the Supreme Leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has endorsed the negotiations. And a congratulatory statement by his office was distributed swiftly right after the agreement had been reached in Geneva, in a way that preempted any naysayers in high places to issue any criticism. And that has really meant that overall, even when there was some criticism, it was muted, generally speaking. And even in the parliament, there was, for a brief moment, some criticism. But then once the Supreme Leader has endorsed the negotiations and the results are perceived to be satisfactory by him, it's a done deal.
So in terms of the young, as I mentioned, most of whom certainly don't remember the Shah and many don't remember the hostage crisis, but they have grown up with a steady diet of death to America and the great Satan. How are they responding?
Well, there were media reports that the negotiating team arrived to a hero's welcome by supporters in Mehrabad Airport in Tehran. And I saw on Mr. Zarif's Facebook page, that's the foreign minister, he actually had thanked supporters for coming to the airport, and he said that he was sorry that the security personnel didn't let him get out of the car, and nothing would have been sweeter than, you know, getting close to these people. And I think this is more important than the reaction of the press. People are relieved, thrilled, and elated by this development. The word on the street, especially their reactions on social media, reflect that kind of sentiment and attitude. Many young people in Iran, as you may know, are, and for the country that has a young population, 70% of the population is under the age of 35, and many of these people have access to social media, have access to outside news sources, and they are much more comfortable at expressing themselves than older audiences. The attitudes by them reflected in these, you know, various places reflect that they are really thrilled about the developments. They are elated, and the feelings expressed, the joy felt and, you know, expressed about the agreement in Geneva was on a par with the election of Rouhani as president, if not bigger. I think it's palpable, that kind of reaction in Iran. Speaking to people, you know, and following the news on state-run media and following the events on social media, it's a stark sort of contrast to what was going on only a few years ago.
Again, I'm speaking with Mehdi Samati, who is a professor in the Department of Communication at Northern Illinois University and the author of many books, including Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. His research interests include international and global communication, cultural politics of globalization, race and media cultures, and Iranian media and culture. So what kind of vision do you think, as much as you can make these generalizations, do the young Iranians feel about their place in the world? Because clearly they have been isolated from the world, and you have, as you just mentioned, 70% of the population in Iran is under 35, and this hostile relationship between the United States and Iran has gone on for, 34 years? So,
yeah. I think that I think you are, you know, very right about your observation. The jovial disposition that Iranians display is about more than the agreement or the details of the agreement, in my opinion. Yes, they are thrilled about the possibility of relief from sanctions. Yes, they're happy that the threat of another war is lessened. But I think that disposition is about something bigger, and that has to do with finding a more dignified position on the global stage that rightfully belongs to them. Iranians are cosmopolitan people. They're proud people. Iran have become a pariah, especially during the last 8 years of Mr. Ahmadinejad's presidency. And the image that Iranians, young people especially, saw themselves in popular media or in the rhetoric of their own politicians and those in the West was not one they deserved. And I think what people are responding to is the possibility of restoring their standing. People know that instinctively. I think the politicians of the West had not taken or have not taken the concept of respect very seriously when it comes to dealing with Iran and Iranian people. I think President Obama gets some credit in this regard. Respect is a fundamental value in Iranian culture, and I think much of this reaction is about that. And people, especially young people, you know, are well aware of how they're perceived outside Iran, how they are portrayed in popular media from Hollywood movies and television programs and basic rhetoric of the press. But they see them, they don't recognize themselves. And this is more about that, I believe. You know, they are seeing that possibility that they are treated with dignity and respect, and they are striving to achieve that, in my opinion, and that's what you see in young people's, you know, attitudes and everything they do when it comes to social media and the opinions they express.
So what was the response in Iran to the movie Argo that won the Academy Award last year?
From everything that I followed, there was, of course, the official reaction by the state media and politicians that they thought, you know, this was representation that distorted their image and their revolutionary, you know, principles. But that's to be expected. I think when it came to people, and young people especially, I think they were more conflicted about it. On the one hand, they're very savvy, and they know that this is Hollywood, it's filmmaking, and even they saw, I think, in the, you know, they saw that the operation, however constrained, there are moments in the film that you see an attempt at humanizing Iranians, but at the end of the day, I think they see it for what it is. It's, you know, Hollywood out to make, you know, money, and but they, deep down, I don't believe anybody is happy with, you know, being depicted the way they were in that film. So there was this, you know, on the one hand, recognition that it's Hollywood, they're making, you know, a film, and but on the other, I think people, again, instinctively know that this is not what they deserve.
So it seems that since the Green Revolution, the protests, the spontaneous protests against what most Iranians, or at least those in the major cities and the young in particular, felt the elections were stolen, and these protests were brutally put down. And since then, it seems that the regime, rather than openly kill dissidents in the streets, obviously nothing on the scale of what's happening in what happened in Egypt and what's happening in Syria, but it does seem like the regime has jailed a lot of its protesters and a lot of journalists, etc. So how is that going to change? You still got the besieged militia, they still got the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, very much in control. My understanding is that the young are pretty fed up with religious strictures of these kind of religious vigilantes. As far as I know, they're not as aggressive as they used to be. You know, they used to go around, ride around on motorcycles and slash people and protesters, etc., and arbitrarily harass women for showing too much hair or too much leg or whatever. Is that still going on?
Well, I think what you're pointing out is correct in the sense that some elements of Iranian politics and Iranian state, you know, haven't changed, even though we've had a new president. I think the public has been willing to give President Rouhani more time to accomplish his campaign pledges. I believe this was a major campaign promise, more important than anything else, that he would reach an agreement with the West. He had said that he would bring a government of moderation and a rational government, and that he would end the nation's isolation on the global stage. And he's delivering on that promise, and rather successfully so. And part of the reason Mr. Rouhani has been embraced by Iranians and even the West is that the previous administration had lowered the bar so dramatically. Having said all of that, I think you're right that some things, you know, some things haven't changed, but I think this is the beginning of, at least as far as Mr. Rouhani's campaign pledges, you know, are concerned. This is the first stage. In some ways, he's been asking for more time, more patience, and one thing that the public has been, I would say, critical about is precisely that. For example, the two individuals perceived to be the leaders of the Green Movement, and the two persons who are under house arrest, and that would be Mr. Mirhossein Mousavi and Mr. Mehdi Karoubi, the public has been wanting to see them out of house arrest, and that hasn't happened yet. But I think the public, again, instinctively knows that can't really expect everything to, you know, overnight to be resolved and every issue and every concern addressed. But I think what's more important than the specific or the individual, you know, demands is this overall horizon of expectations that in Iran is changing. Increasingly, people are not, you know, accepting of what used to be, you know, the norms of the conduct by the state. So I think in the long term, there will be expectations that those things will change as well. But for right now, they are willing to give him more time to accomplish, you know, one promise at a time. So I think you're right, but things are moving in that direction, and there are hopeful signs that he might be able to achieve a lot more than what we see right now.
So, Mehdi Samadi, what do you think, though, is the relationship between Rouhani and the Supreme Leader who has endorsed this agreement? But at the same time, while Rouhani has moderated his views enormously about, particularly about Israel, and signaled a change in the rhetoric, the Supreme Leader has not. He's still talking about essentially, you know, wiping Israel off the map and this kind of rhetoric that we associate with Ahmadinejad.
Yes. I think what's different about Mr. Rouhani is that he's always been a sort of a pragmatic and a practical sort of politician, even if he was caught up, you know, in the rhetoric at the time, the sort of revolutionary rhetoric. But he's always been a person who had practical and pragmatic views. And I believe his ties to the system, to the regime, you know, right down to the very sensitive, you know, security apparatus, are deep, and those ties are serving him well. And in some ways, you know, it is one could see the Supreme Leader basically using him to stabilize what was being a very untenable situation for the Islamic Republic. Now, I should add that this is sometimes some of these changes are irreversible. For example, people, as I said, you know, horizon of expectations is now moving and or changing, and that is in some ways irreversible. I should also add that Supreme Leader of, you know, the Islamic Republic has very savvy political manner has framed the success and negotiations as something that Mr. Rouhani and his team has accomplished. By definition, that means you own it. That means if there is at some point, you know, any issues that he has with the conduct of the West, he has left himself some room to renege and say that, this is something that you were involved with and you accomplished. But at the same time, I think, you know, we should recognize that the decision has been made for various reasons by the Supreme Leader that this is the strategy that they want to pursue, and for, as I said, for various reasons, and Mr. Rouhani happens to be the right person to accomplish, you know, these goals. I think there were media reports about back channel talks, you know, as far back as March of last year, and this year, that Americans had reached out to the office of the Supreme Leader, and that President Obama had sent letters to the Supreme Leader quite, you know, some time ago. Now, none of that means that what Mr. Rouhani is doing, you know, an important, or that we should take away anything from the way he's been accomplishing the goals that he set out to accomplish. But that politics in Iran is factious, it is fractured, and that it's a factional politics, and that means it's a very complicated, you know, situation. But Mr. Rouhani has proved to be very skillful in navigating these difficult waters of Iranian politics. And I should also add that about the rhetoric of, you know, wiping Israel off the map. There's been some debates about what exactly do they mean. The debate is this, you know, At least the spirit of that kind of rhetoric has meant to, you know, imply or say that if there were to be elections, free elections held within then the territories where the occupied territories and, you know, the that area generally, through some elections, you know, then would have a drastic, a different, you know, arrangement in government. That's different from saying that issuing explicit military threat that we're going to, you know, bomb you. And, of course, this doesn't mean I endorse that sort of rhetoric. And they have done themselves, you know, quite a bit of disservice by engaging in that kind of rhetoric. But even that sort of statement should be viewed in that context. And I should also add that people in Iran and in the West and even inside Israel know that there is no military solution to this nuclear issue. And I should also add that, in my judgment, the value of sanctions is overstated. Think about this. Iran has been under sanctions in one form or another for the past, you know, 30 years. And despite those sanctions, Iran has managed to increase its nuclear activities. The enrichment, you know, capacity that they have has gone up under these sanctions. So if sanctions were working, Iran would not be in this position to negotiate. So I think President Obama gets credit here for basically accepting that there is no military solution and that there is limit to how much sanctions can do, and that ultimately the only path forward is that of a diplomatic solution. And it looks like for now, contrary to the efforts by hardliners in Israel, in Iran, and in the United States, especially in U.S. government, the Senate, and the Congress, that path is being pursued and successfully so far.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Mehdi Samati.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Mehdi Samati, who's a professor in the Department of Communication at Northern Illinois University and the author of many books, including Media, Culture, and Society in Iran, Living with Globalization and the Islamic State. His research interests include international and global communication, cultural politics of globalization, race and media cultures, and Iranian media and culture. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with the Catholic theologian Matthew Fox about the just-released document from Pope Francis. מפנה מקום בבטן שאוכל לבלוע אותך אני מפנה מקום בתיבה למכתבים שלך Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Fox, who's an internationally acclaimed theologian who was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years. Fox founded the Institute in Culture and Creation Spirituality, which operated for 7 years, but then became a chief target of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Pope John Paul II's chief inquisitor and head of the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith. Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, silenced Fox for 1 year in 1988 and ultimately forced him to step down as director of the ICCS. 3 years later, he expelled Fox from the order. Matthew Fox is the author of 28 books, which have sold more than 1.5 million copies. His bestsellers include Original Blessings, A Spirituality Named Compassion, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ, and Prayer, A Radical Response to Life. His latest book is The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Fox.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be with you.
And I'm just wondering, given what appears to be a very different Pope Francis from his predecessors, whether the cardinals who chose him are having buyer's remorse.
I think some are and some aren't. You know, I think that the cardinals were, some of them are pretty aware that things were absolutely sinking in the Catholic Church as we know it, and they wanted a reform. And I think clearly this fellow is putting his best into it. I actually wrote a small book this year called Letters to Pope Francis that's just coming out in Italian this week. In it, I speak to him about some ways he could accomplish reform both inside the church and outside. But I do think that he's showing signs of life, his refusal to move into the palace, for example, and his obvious public stance in favor of the poor as opposed to what he calls wild economic liberalism and so forth. I think he has a real sense. Of course, he comes from the third world, and so I think he has a sense of what the economic system as it's running today is doing to the poor as well as to the other creatures. I think that's why he chose the name Francis, that he has a sense of ecology and what's happening with global warming and so much health on the planet. So, yeah, he is a breath of fresh air for sure.
And he talks about, of course, the global capitalism in terms of a globalization of indifference. And it's in this new document that's just been released, he's calling upon the church to refocus on the poor. And he's basically, not that other popes haven't talked about the ills of capitalism, he does talk about the new idolatry of money. And given the disparity of wealth in this country and how many of the countries in the world appear to be run by oligarchs, including the United States in many ways, it's refreshing to hear that.
Well, it is. He says, and I quote, "Christianity condemns both communism and wild capitalism with the same vigor." So definitely he's trying to talk about an economic system that would work for everybody, and that doesn't mean just the humans, but all the creatures of the earth. One of the proposals I make in my letters to him is that he and the Dalai Lama go on a world tour together and talk about these kind of things, about a revolution of values, about ecology and about poverty and how we could have an economic system that works for everyone and not just a few, about gender justice toward women. Now there I think the church itself has a lot to learn internally, but nevertheless I think that if the two of them were to go out like that, it would it could make a difference because there's so many people working at the grassroots to try to change things for the good, and they can use some wind in their sails, and I think the kind of publicity that the two of them would get as a tag team would put wind in their sails. I also think they'd get along fine and they'd teach one another something.
Well,
what do you think of that, the Dalai Lama and the Pope on a world tour?
Well,
I... Six concepts.
Who would be the warm-up act?
Well, there's a good question. Are you nominating yourself?
No way. But let me ask you, Matthew Fox, about the general tone here of this new document the Pope's released, where he talks about that he prefers a church that was bruised, hurting, and dirty because it has been out on the streets rather than a church which is unhealthy from being confined and from clinging to its own security. And this is, of course, you mentioned he doesn't live in the palace, he doesn't have a limousine, and that is a refreshing change, I think, in itself, isn't it?
Well, it really is. And needless to say that the right wing is getting fits over this guy, and... So it's going to be an interesting spectacle to watch to see just how some of the more convinced, orthodox, entrenched wings of the church respond to this kind of invitation. But at least it sounds something much closer to St. Francis's vision and obviously to that of Jesus as well. So as you say, it's very welcome. And one of the main points I make in my letters to him is that he chose the name Francis, and so he sets the bar very high because people do know the basics of Francis's vision. And so in a way, he was asking for this, I think, And I encourage him. I support him, and I hope he can pull it off. I also hope he's allowed to live, because I think there are powerful forces that don't aren't in his camp on such subjects as he's raising.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Fox, who's an internationally acclaimed theologian who was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years. He founded the Institute in Culture and Creation Spirituality. He was essentially hounded out of the church by Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, and he was expelled from the order. And he's the author of 28 books, which have sold more than 1.5 million copies. And his most recent book is The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved. And you just mentioned you've written also a subsequent book of letters to Pope Francis. In terms of reforming the church, specifically, and of course, the new document does reiterate the church's opposition to the ordination of women, and said that's not a question open to discussion. But in terms of reforms, he apparently had a recent meeting with a group of cardinals to consider ways to reform the Vatican bureaucracy. And he also this month launched an unprecedented survey of the views of lay Catholics on modern family life and sexual ethics. So tell me about that, because I know when he said recently that the church is obsessed with abortion, that really seemed to single out these very right-wing bishops we have here in the United States.
Very much so. And there's no question that he's trying to decentralize the Vatican, which has obviously become super, uber-centralized in the last 34 years with the previous two popes. But I think it's a shame that that he's already ruled out discussion again about women's role in leadership and ministry. First of all, because the scholarship is deeply flawed in the Catholic Church about the history of this. They're telling us women can't be ordained priests because Jesus only ordained men, but Jesus did not ordain men. Ordination happened in the second century, not the first century. And there were many women leaders in the early church. Paul names them by name, these leaders who accompanied him and also hosted him in many different cities. So it's simply not accurate that the argument they have is neither biblical nor historically founded. So I think that's a pity. Also, in another statement earlier, this Pope had said that we need a women's theology in the church. Well, there's been a women's theology for 45 years. Women have been writing marvelous theology, and they've been shut down. And I, a man, was accused by Ratzinger. His number one objection to my theology was that I'm a feminist theologian. So there's been plenty of women's and feminist theology going on, and to say that we need one is, I don't know, it's kind of scary. One is where he's been the last 45 years, secluded from women's wisdom like that. But at the same time, yeah, I'm glad that he's pushing the reform of the church from the inside, and I wish him well. There's so much to be reformed, and people, you know, aren't waiting around with the younger generation. I did another book this year called Occupy Spirituality with Adam Bucko, an activist and contemplative in New York City, working with street youth. And it's about young adults and spirituality. We did a lot of surveys of young people, and they're just not waiting around for the church to get its act together. They're moving, and they're moving around political issues, which I think Pope Francis would be on board with, such as Occupy represented, issues of justice and economic justice, but also they're moving around issues of deep ecumenism and interspirituality, interfaith, and bringing the contemplative and the active together. So I think that there's a lot happening in the world today, and it'd be great if the Pope got on board, and it's too bad that he's kind of resisting the women's thing, because I don't think you're going to reform any organization by having it all in the hands of men. I don't think a pedophile crisis like this could have occurred if women had been in positions of leadership and questioning, it became a men's club, and they were covering up for one another. Obviously, these cardinals, like Cardinal Law, were covering things up, and I don't think women would have allowed them to get away with that.
So, Matthew Fox, just back to the Pope's document. This is what is music to my ears. I beg the Lord to grant us more politicians who are genuinely disturbed by the state of society, the people, the lives of the poor. Here we are in a country where the last election was about between $6 and $10 billion. And I mentioned that we're effectively a plutocracy as opposed to a democracy. And you've got these Republicans in Congress who just cut food stamps for the poor, one of whom quoted the Bible saying that he who does not work doesn't deserve to be fed. And yet this guy's getting his family farm in Tennessee is getting huge subsidies from the taxpayer. So do you think with the people like Boehner and Ryan as self-professed Catholics, do you think that Francis is going to have an effect on them?
One can pray for miracles, but I think you named the situation, that there's a whole politics of denial here, and it's a politics of serving and being served by the large corporate interests. It's government of the corporations, by the corporations, and for the corporations. And like you say, I think it's a good thing for the Pope to call for politicians who are generally disturbed by poverty. And a lot of that, of course, is things like food stamps and so forth. But also, it's about not having jobs, or, if you will, about having such low-paying jobs that even people with full-time work have to go on food stamps because the wages are so low, while McDonald's and Walmart and all the others are making untold millions and billions of profits. So it is a system that seriously needs revamping. And like you say, unfortunately, the politicians are in their lap. And, of course, so are legislatures and judges and the rest. I mean, it becomes a system that's self-serving. And, we need people rattling the cages, and it's good that the Pope is one of those people.
Well, Matthew Fox, I appreciate you joining us here today.
Well, thank you, and always good to be with you.
And again, I've been speaking with Matthew Fox, who's an internationally acclaimed theologian who was a member of the Dominican Order for 34 years. He founded the Institute in Culture and Creation Spirituality, which operated for 7 years, but then became a chief target of Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, Pope John Paul II's chief inquisitor, the head of the Congregation of Doctrine and Faith. Ratzinger, who later became Pope Benedict, silenced Fox for 1 year in 1988, but ultimately forced him to step down as director of ICCS, and 3 years later he expelled Fox from the order. Matthew Fox is the author of 28 books, which have sold more than 1.5 million copies. His bestsellers include Original Blessings, A Spirituality Named Compassion, The Coming of the Cosmic Christ, and Prayer, A Radical Response to Life. His latest book is The Pope's War, Why Ratzinger's Secret Crusade Has Imperiled the Church and How It Can Be Saved. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.